I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia, at thecommentary.ca. A few weeks ago, upon the news of the death of Carol Channing, I tweeted that there's a great David Berner interview he did with her in 1994 when she was in town for another production of Hello, Dolly. There was some interest in the tape, so I uploaded it to SoundCloud, and Drex over at CKNW, who happens to occupy David's old time slot, very graciously posted it. I emailed David soon after and caught up with him over lunch. He mentioned a couple of new projects, and he's agreed to come on, come in today to talk about them. David Berner will be presenting That Reminds Me of a Story, an evening with David Berner, Saturday the 30th of March at 8 p.m. It'll be at the PAL Studio Theater, and it's a fundraiser for PAL Vancouver, the Performing Arts Lodge on Cardero Street. David will share stories from his life in show business, broadcasting, writing, and addictions therapy. He's interviewed everybody. Tickets will be at the door that night, and you're asked to donate $20 or a lot more as it goes to a great cause. Something else David is involved in is the Psychodrama Experience. It's a workshop conducted by David and clinical counselor Jeff Iabonte. That's Saturday the 20th of April and Sunday the 21st of April at the Granville Island Hotel. Visit newhistory.ca/psychodrama for tickets and information. I'll get David to tell us about these two worthwhile events and more. We'll probably talk about old movies and old interviews and whatever else is on our minds. David Berner is probably best known for his many years as a broadcaster at CJOR and CKNW. He has conducted thousands of hours of therapy, counseling, and process groups. As well, he's performed as an actor in film, television, and the stage. He was a columnist. And the list of people he's interviewed has included award-winning performers, athletes, murderers, and saints. Visit davidberner.com. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, David Berner. Mr. Berner, good morning.
Hello, Joseph. I hate to start off this way, but I must make a correction.
Yes,
a beautiful introduction, but perhaps I misled you. I have to be very careful about this. The show at PAL on the 30th, Saturday the 30th, is literally not a fundraiser because the people who run the theater there are very sensitive about that, and they have their own fundraising activities, so they don't like anybody to bill themselves as a fundraiser. The deal is that I'm not taking any money. I just want to see how this kind of evening will work, and all of the revenue that comes in, it shouldn't be a fortune, but there's 130 seats, I think, will go to paying for the theater.
Okay. Proceeds will go to PAL.
Probably whatever is left will go to PAL.
It's good to see you again.
Good to see you.
This idea of you going on stage and talking to people, I mean, it just seems like a natural fit.
Yes. Yeah, well, I remember when the late John Giuliani, the director, and the writer Mark Lyron Young approached me about doing Shylock. They said, Mark sent me the script, and he sent me a letter, and it said, we need a great actor, we need a Jewish actor, and we need an actor who's not afraid to break the fourth wall. Well, that's what I did for a living, just talk on the radio. So this idea actually came from the great local actor Simon Webb, because Simon and I are buddies, and every 3 months or so we spend 2 hours over a coffee, and he said, you know, I think you're a terrific actor, and I've seen the things you've done, and you're great. But I think you're just about the best storyteller I've ever met, and you should just do an evening telling stories. So I'm going to do that, and the way I'm going to do it is kind of fun, because it's almost like an improv night. I've got a stack of index cards, and I've got one word or a person's name.
Yeah.
Like the first card I have is Ray Milland. That's going to lead to almost 20 minutes of storytelling about many people, okay? But the other thing I'm doing is before I come on stage, someone from the Performers Arts Lodge, PAL, an usher or someone, will hand everyone who shows up an index card and a golf pencil.
Uh-huh.
I went to Staples the other day and bought a box of golf pencils, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're going to ask everyone to write the name of a person, place, or thing on a card, and this person, the usher, will collect all of that and give them to me, and I'll put them on the table next to my stack, and I'll do my stack, and I'll do one for my stack, then I'll pick up someone from the audience.
Yeah.
And if it says elephant, I'll see if I can do something about elephants. If I can't, I'll say, well, I've never...
Ginger Rogers.
Oh, well, I mean, I've said that I'm gone for 20 minutes. Yeah.
This gift of storytelling, I mean, we've talked about this before, but it's what's drawn people to you over the years, but radio and television and everything else you've done. Where does that come from?
It comes from growing up in a house full of storytellers. I was the only short person in a big house filled with tall people. And they
You're pretty tall yourself now that I think
Now, but I was 5'6".
Oh, okay.
And they went to this, except for my grandmother, who was taller than me at that time. She stayed home and cooked all day and cleaned, I guess. But the other people went to this place called Work. And then at the end of the day, they came home, and we all sat around the kitchen table every single night except during high holidays when we were allowed to go into the dining room, you know, with tablecloths and fancy food and different dishes and all that. But we sat around the table and everybody told stories. There were two subjects, basically. What happened at work today? And don't you remember from the old country?
Yeah.
Because they were Russian Jewish immigrants. So I sat there, and as talkative as I am, as you know me to be, I sat there a mute as a kid, swiveling my head back and forth, watching people and listening to them.
Yeah.
So I was surrounded by storytellers, and I just thought that's what you're supposed to do.
So you've
also, I have to say, to be honest, to be further psychologically honest, I'm also one of these sick people who starve for attention. So I'm always, I have to tell you a story.
So this is, as I said, it's a natural fit because you get to tell these marvelous stories that all of us want to hear, and then in front of an audience, and that fulfills your need for attention,
I guess. Absolutely. Yeah.
That's the thing about performing. You as a performer, you as an actor, I've seen some of the things that you've done as an actor. And I think, and I'm not patronizing you, but I think this is the case with the good performers. The good actors is that they make it look easy, and you make it look easy. Does it feel easy?
Yes. Let me put it this way: one of my hugest heroes in all of life, especially in showbiz, is Fred Astaire.
Mm-hmm.
Fred Astaire was complimented to his dying days in the same manner. He was told that he made it look easy. We all know from his stories and from people who worked with him and from Ginger Rogers stories and so on, that they worked until their feet bled, you know, to make it look easy. So I would say that as an actor, I cannot believe how much work I put into doing a piece as an actor. I could show you this. I have two copies of the working script of Shylock, for example, because I exhausted one copy.
Yeah.
Every word has about seven notes that I've made over the course of rehearsal and running it and so on, trying to deconstruct every moment and think about what every moment is and so on. But once you do that, you know, among other things, I teach public speaking and I teach acting and so on. Well, my seventh step in public speaking is the Nike slogan, just do it. I mean, you prepare, you prepare, you prepare, and then you just dive off the damn diving board and shut your face and just go do it. Get out on that football field and throw a pass.
So all these things, like you hear this about good actors, like Maureen Stapleton, for example, was terrified about, you know, after the show, and that's why she drank, I guess.
Yes.
What if it doesn't work on stage? How are you off stage in terms of dealing with whatever reaction, good, bad, or indifferent from the audience?
I've rarely had a really dreadful reaction from an audience, but I will tell you one experience that was salutary, and I'll never forget it. It was an important moment. I did a play, is it Bernie Slade who wrote it? He's a Canadian who was sort of the Canadian Neil Simon, and he had two huge hits. I think one was same time next year. But anyway, the other one was Tribute, and Tribute went on Broadway with Jack Lemmon in the lead role. And,
in the movie, too, right?
Yeah. So I did this at Stage West Dinner Theater in Edmonton, 4-month run.
Right.
And I played the second banana, Uncle Lou, who runs the Tribute. The key character is a guy named Scotty, who is dying of cancer. So I come out in a tuxedo, and I talk to the audience about why we've asked you here tonight and so on. And then I step away, and I become part of the play, and I'm just dressed in ordinary clothes, and I'm in the action of the play. At the end, I come back out, doing the Tribute. So we did it for 4 months, 8 shows a week. Came home to Vancouver. That was in Edmonton. Came home. I was home like 2 weeks, and the director phoned me and said, David, Winnipeg, another 4 months. I said, absolutely. So I went to Winnipeg. We had the same wonderful actor in the key role. He was an actor who sort of destroyed his own career. He was in that show with some young girls, and was it Charlotte Ray, a woman, a sort of largish, roundish woman who was sort of running them?
Like a girls' school?
Something like that. Yeah. I can't remember what it was called, but in any event, he...
Facts of Life.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think that was the one. So anyways, he was a key part of it, but he got angry about the morality of some episode or something, and he walked out, and basically we never saw him again. But anyway, he was terrific in this role. We did opening night in Winnipeg at Stage West Dinner Theater, and I thought I'd done perfectly fine, and I was sitting in my dressing room just getting out of those clothes, and Lawler and the girl from Edmonton who was cast again as the whore, the two of them came in and glared at me, and I looked up at them, and I said, what? What's the matter? And they said, what are you doing? I said, pardon me? And they said, where's Uncle Lou? Where's lovable Uncle Lou? I said, I don't know what you're talking about. They said, Lou, who we have loved working with for the last 4 months, has been replaced by this smart aleck, wiseacre, know-it-all. We're just wondering when Lou's going to come back. And I went into shock because nobody's – I don't have people speaking to me that way. So, or at least I don't expect it.
Right.
So I said, oh, my God, okay, I have to think about that. And I went back to my – I had an apartment hotel, and I went back and I agonized over what they said, and I realized what had happened. It was ego. I was so caught up with having a successful 4-month run of a play that I just thought I was the cat's ass, and I couldn't do anything wrong. And I really hadn't retouched the play. I was just busy being a successful actor. And it was a huge lesson in humility. And the next night we did the show, and the two actors came backstage smiling and gave me big hugs. They said, thank you.
Yeah.
Uncle Lou is back. Now, I'm not alone, because here's a great showbiz story.
Yeah.
Josh Logan, who directed South Pacific, the original, right, only with Mary Martin and Ezio Pinza,
yeah,
a smash, crazy hit on Broadway. So they go, after a year or two, they go to the West End in London, and they're Mary Martin and Ezio Pinza, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's not there the first couple nights. He has the stage manager just handle everything. I mean, they're two of the best people in the world, right? And he shows up, same exact. He goes backstage. He said, what are you two idiots doing? And they're shocked.
Yeah.
Well, what are you talking? It's I won't redo the story, but it's the same story. It can happen. So really, I mean, other than that, I've rarely had anyone give me a bad time, and I don't know that I've ever walked off a stage at the end saying that was terrible. I can get a little obsessed about a moment that I didn't like, but you know what? When you have a moment that you don't like, the audience usually hasn't noticed it. It's just your internal critic. Yeah.
And then it's something that you obviously glean from, you learn from, right?
Yeah, I mean, here's a funny example where the audience didn't see it. I once had the great pleasure of playing Fagin in the musical Oliver. Uh-huh. So when we did it the first time at Theater Under the Stars in 87, I did the worst thing an actor could ever do. And this is what I did, it was what caused me to go blank. We're in the middle of Pick a Pocket, the song Pick a Pocket. And in the middle of Pick a Pocket, there's a pause while the music vamps underneath, and the boys are handing me handkerchiefs and wallets that they've stolen. That's their job, right? Yeah, yeah. And I had some line in the middle of that. I don't remember what the line was. And I started thinking to myself, that was great. Oh, gee, I never said that line that way before. Oh, yeah. I really like that. And after what seemed like an eternity, but was probably 2 seconds, I looked around at the boys and I thought, well, isn't someone going to speak? Whose line is it? Yeah. I didn't say that. And I suddenly realized it was my line. And I was so busy stroking myself and patting myself on the back that I blanked. Now, fortunately, I don't think the audience noticed. And I've had moments like that on the radio.
Right.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
I've told you this story before, but it's such a great story. Yeah. And it's one of the stories I'll tell on March 30th because it has to be told. So CJOR, a little burner in the night, 10 o'clock at night to 1 in the morning. The kid behind the glass, the producer, operator, he says, David, Mr. Pesum's on the way up with some friends. Oh, okay. So if there's anybody listening who doesn't remember, Murray Pesum was a flamboyant stockbroker, widely rumored to be a crook. But
he owned the Lions, too, at one point.
Did he?
Yeah, I think.
Okay, so why do I associate it with the Penthouse nightclub? Did he have something to do with the Penthouse?
He probably looked like Joe.
Yeah. Anyways, so sure enough, as we're coming on the air, in walks Murray Pesum with 3 friends. And he sits down and he says, David, it's so great to see you. We just got off a plane from Las Vegas and I couldn't resist bringing my friends with you. Of course, you know them all. Here's Joey Bishop, Dodie Goodman, and Phil Foster. Now, Dodie Goodman and Phil Foster are Las Vegas comics, and Phil Foster taught comedy. Joey Bishop is a member of the Rat Pack.
Right.
And when I watched, as I hope millions did, the JFK inaugural on PBS. Did you watch that?
I saw part of it, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I recorded it, and it's phenomenal. Sinatra put together this evening in the Armory, which, by the way, was freezing, apparently.
Yeah.
And who was it who couldn't get back?
Ethel Merman couldn't
change. Yeah, she couldn't get back and change, so she just played it in a cardigan or something. Yeah. Anyway. This amazing show. Of course, Joey Bishop was part of that. And Joey Bishop had his own late-night talk show. And he was in all these movies. He's Joey Bishop. And then Murray Pesum does the following, which caused me to go absolutely ashen, okay, and silent. He says, so I was telling Joey and Dodie and Phil on the way over here, oh, we have to stop and see David Berner. He's hands down the funniest guy in the world. and I'm going, oh my God, this lunatic just told Joey Bishop that I'm the funniest guy in the world. Joey Bishop hangs out with Jerry Lewis, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, give me a break. Well, I went totally blank, which seemed to me like the blankness was 20 minutes.
Right.
I listened to the tape.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't even 2 seconds. It was a beat. And Joey Bishop, bless his heart, he saw it in my eyes. That and he knew as soon as Murray opened his mouth that was the dumbest thing you could say. And Joey rescued me, and he just jumped in and saved the day.
Yeah. So that speaks to talent, doesn't it? Someone like him would know when to step in.
If you watch, you know YouTube Jerry Lewis interviews, YouTube Jerry Lewis with that annoying but very successful guy from the Actor's Studio.
James Lipton.
Yeah, Lipton.
Yeah.
I've never liked his style, but he does great work, you know, in spite of the way he does it. And, of course, he gets the greatest people in the world. You look at that interview and other interviews with Jerry Lewis, and Jerry Lewis will talk about the spontaneous magic that happens between performers. Dean Martin was not a tumbler from the Catskills like Jerry Lewis was. Jerry Lewis was doing this since he was a kid, you know. Martin was a guy who sang songs.
Yeah.
But he had all these natural instincts, and he just was present. Two quick remarks about that, just to illustrate the truth of it. The great Helen Hayes, after whom a theater is named in New York, was once watching TV mid-evening, and the phone rang, and it was some friend of hers. He said, "I'm sorry, I can't talk. I'll call you back at the top of the hour. I'm watching Dean Martin," and hung up. And then, you know, 9 o'clock or whenever, she phoned back, and her friend said, "Helen, what, was that a joke? What? You were watching Dean Martin and couldn't talk to me?" She said, "Yeah." "You watched Dean Martin?" She said, "Yeah." Helen Hayes said, "Yeah, I think he's the greatest actor I've ever seen," which I think is true. But the other truth about that story is that Dean Martin was, CBS begged him for 3-4 years to do a weekly variety show. And he kept saying no. He didn't want to do it. And finally he said what he thought would get them off his back. He said, "I'll tell you what. I'll do the show on one condition." They said, "What?" He said, "No, I don't have to rehearse."
Yeah.
And they said, "Done." And he did it and had this immensely successful show. And he'd just walk in and there'd be cue cards everywhere. And maybe they'd have a quick read through or something, you know, a table read or something. And he'd just do it because he was a guy who was just present.
Yeah.
You know, he was right there, whatever was happening.
And the sad part is after his son died, he would be sitting at Chasen's or something having his dinner alone.
Yes.
And then people would naturally want to come over and say hello or you know, that knew him and wanted to chat. And he would sit there. And as soon as he saw someone come up to him that he didn't want to talk to, he'd pretend he was nodding off just to avoid them.
I never heard that before.
Yeah. I mean,
that's wonderful.
I mean, that's someone who could perform like that and yet not want to.
Absolutely.
You know.
No, everybody who knows the story says that when his son died, a huge piece of Dean Martin died. He just almost gave up on life.
Yeah.
But I will tell you a book very quickly, my favorite Chasen story.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Benny and George Burns were best of friends, and their relationship went as follows. Whatever George Burns said, Jack Benny was on the floor weeping with laughter.
Yeah.
Whatever Jack said, George never cracked a smile. But they were the best of friends, and they lived across the street from each other.
Yeah.
Okay? So I could tell you 20 stories. Irving Feld, who was the agent for Jack Benny, when Jack died, Irving walked across the street and became the agent for George Burns. And Irving Feld wrote the definitive biography, Jack Benny.
Yeah.
If you haven't read it, read it. It's one of the best books I ever read about a showbiz person.
Yeah.
Anyway, this great story. They're sitting in Chasen. Benny and Burns are sitting in Chasen, which reminds me, as a sidebar, the first person I interviewed on a little burner in the night was Soupy Sales.
Right.
And he was on the phone from New York. And I said, this is how we started. I said, "So, Soup, you know, my three favorite comedians are Benny, Burns, and Burl. So my first question is, how come your name don't start with a B?" And he loved that. He loved that guy. Anyway, Benny and Burns are sitting in Chasen's, and George says out of nowhere, "Jack, I've got a wonderful idea. When Dave Chasen comes around to say hello, as inevitably he will, I'm going to say to him, no, it'll be better this way. You say to him, 'Dave, I'll be picking up the tab for this dinner. Do not let George say a word about the bill, okay? And don't take money from him. And before he can catch his breath, I'll jump in and say, no, I'm going to," and so on, you know. So, and Jack says, "Oh, that's funny. That's great." Sure enough, Chasen comes around. He says, "Gentlemen," and George stares at Jack, and Jack goes, "Dave, you know, I'm going to pay for this meal.
Yeah.
So if George says a word, don't pay him any mind." And Jack looks over to George and smiles, and George sits there and does nothing. The story goes that they carried Jack out of the restaurant because he was so weak from laughing.
And here's the great thing about all of this. You grew up watching these people, liking them, idolizing them, and then you got—I mean, you mentioned Fred Astaire earlier.
Yes.
You got to know Ginger Rogers, didn't you? You interviewed her once.
I had an unbelievable day with Ginger Rogers. She was here doing something at the Plazas Room, which was in the bottom of the Plaza Hotel at the foot of Capilano Road on Marine Drive, which is now a condo.
Right.
But for a long time, it was like the tallest building in the Lower Mainland.
It was a hotel, right?
And it was a hotel. And I've forgotten his name. We all know him. The guy who ran the Plazas Room. He's a character who owned restaurants and so on. Anyway, so she was here, and she was in a two-room penthouse apartment, which they called the Ginger Rogers Suite. And I went up to interview her.
Mm-hmm.
I was working for CBC Television at the time, and I had a cameraman with color film stock. You know, this is long before video. And I was in tennis shorts and a T-shirt, and I had just come from the tennis court, and I was just learning tennis, and I had enthusiastically run for a wide forehand shot and smashed myself on the forehead with my racket. And I think we went to the doctor. Somebody put a butterfly bandage on my forehead, and I didn't have a concussion, okay? But so I show up. She comes down a spiral staircase. She was 67, and she looked like she was 30. And she came down wearing these beautiful slacks and this beautiful flowing shirt and high heels. And she came down the stairs like Ginger Rogers, you know. And of course, the same with Carol Channing, the same kind of thing. Oh, David, I've been looking so forward to meeting you. Who the hell am I? You know, but that's... That's what stars like that would do.
Okay?
Anyway, I had forgotten or didn't know, A, that she was a mother, B, she was a tennis player, and C, she was a Christian Scientist.
Mm-hmm.
So when she saw this bandage, she said, "What's that?" And I told her I'd played tennis and zonked myself with my own racket. Well, that just brought out everything in her. We had the most wonderful, wonderful interview, and she was absolutely the most charming, warm-hearted, down-to-earth person who was a giant movie star.
And so what's that like when you think, I used to watch her on the big screen as a kid or you know, followed her career?
I'll tell you what it's like, Joseph. The only time that I remember, maybe it happened other times, but with all these people like Ginger Rogers and Tony Bennett and Carol Channing and so on, I just found them to be delightful, down-to-earth, sweet people.
Yeah.
The only time I was ever struck dumb with awe was Dizzy Gillespie was here also playing at the Plazas Room.
Mm-hmm.
And I was then doing the show, Little Burner in the Night, from the lobby of the Four Seasons Hotel. And we invited him to come with his sax player, whose name I don't remember. The guy was a terrific musician. And we knew that the sax player for sure was a vegetarian, and maybe Dizzy was, I can't remember. But anyway, we had the kitchen prepare some mm-hmm. appropriate food for them, and they didn't get there till midnight.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just fine, because I was on from 10:05 to 1 in the morning. And they showed up. You know, we had a taxi waiting for them as soon as they finished their gig, and they came over. And the sax player didn't say much. He was enjoying eating and listening. And Dizzy was wonderful. He was absolutely wonderful. But I confess that in the middle of the interview, and this is the only time I can remember this happening, I found myself staring at him and going, "Oh, my God, this guy is one of the four seminal geniuses of the American art form called jazz." I mean, this has got one of the guys.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, who else is there? Louis Armstrong, Thelonious Monk, you know, a handful of people. And he's one of them. And he's a genius and a pioneer. And for a few moments, I was just sitting there with my jaw dropped and staring at him.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then I got over it. We continued. And again, you couldn't hear it in the tape.
Yeah.
Because he was talking, you know. Yeah.
And of all the careers you have, we'll talk about being a therapist and a counselor in just a second. Was broadcasting the most rewarding?
No, but broadcasting was certainly a ton of fun. It was very rewarding. I mean, sometimes it was frustrating as hell, but it was very rewarding because I met the most extraordinary people. I met a lot of reasonably ordinary people. I met a lot of politicians. That's always not always the most fun. So, mm-hmm. Politicians are all charming. That's their stock and trade. But half of them are nitwits, and all of them, I believe, are people who want to be in showbiz but don't have the
talent,
the talent or the discipline to do the work.
Yeah.
But you know what? I love broadcasting, both radio and television, because I'm a storyteller, and to me, I didn't realize this until about. See, I'm 76, so I don't know, maybe till I was about 60 or something, mm-hmm. I suddenly remembered that when I was about 10 or 11, a new CBC physical plant opened to replace all the old little mm-hmm. places they had in Winnipeg where I was growing up. And we went on a school excursion to see the new CBC facilities. And I didn't remember this until I was in my 60s. Mm-hmm. But then I remembered it clearly. We were taken on this tour of the new CBC studios, and I remember walking into a sound studio where they would do radio.
Yeah.
And I remember the feeling of, oh, yeah, good, I could do this. Yeah, I'm comfortable here. And it's just, I don't know, some people will walk into a paddock or a corral and smell horses and go, yeah, this is me.
This is home.
This is home. I can do that.
Yeah.
And I have felt that way about stages, you know, proscenium stages, radio studios, television studios, movie sets. I just feel at home. I don't know why. I can't explain it. It's just, to me, it's natural.
Yeah. What I want to talk about these events on April 20th and 21st. So if it's called the Psychodrama Experience.
Right.
What does that mean?
Well, psychodrama is a particular exercise, a form of therapy that was largely devised and then sort of propagated by a great psychiatrist at the Hudson Institute in New York named H.L. Marino 100 years ago. And Marino's number one pupil was a guy who grew up in the New York area but spent most of his life in California and several times was awarded best professor in the California University chain. And he wrote many, many books. His name was Louis Yablonsky, and you'll see on that ad that I brought you this quote by Louis Yablonsky. And when I was 24 years old, I had the extraordinary experience of, A, being invited to sit in on a psychodrama session.
Uh-huh.
There were about 90 people, and he selected me out of the crowd to work with him. And I did something that was kind of unbelievable, and he loved it, and we became great friends. Psychodrama is an exercise in which you physicalize what people are talking about and you make it real in the moment. So if someone is saying, I had a problem with my wife yesterday or something. So you get someone to play the wife and then there are other characters and you quickly discover that the problem with his wife is that he has a problem with his mother, so suddenly you're back to him being 5 years old and the mother is part of the scene and you play all this stuff out and there are other voices, like you get different shades of what he's really feeling that he can't quite express. So often, for example, the two opposites when someone's working that are present but hard to express are rage and sadness, rage and sorrow, anger mm-hmm. and sorrow. And so you have people trying those on for size and saying, is that valid? You feel, yeah. And you get, it's just a way for people to feel what they're really feeling. The greatest example I can give you is grief. People do a ton of things called grief counseling. I don't know how anyone, by the way, can make that their life work, a grief counselor. Because I think if you're really doing it, it would kill you. It's exhausting.
Yeah.
But I've done tons of grief work. Yeah. You know, it just comes up naturally. If you're working with addicts and alcoholics, there's tons of sorrow. Mm-hmm. Whoa. So what do you do? Well, I'll tell you what I do in psychodrama. So someone says, my best friend died, and they say, yeah, how? And they tell you how, and you say, and what is this person's name? James. Okay. And I look across the room, and I go, hey, Jeremy, come here. Come lie down in front of our friend here. And you don't have to do anything. Just lie there. You know, and they say, okay, well, here's, you know, it's your lucky day. Here's your friend James. You went to his funeral, didn't you? And the person says, yeah. But, of course, you were high. You were stoned. You couldn't deal with how you really felt. Yeah, that's right. Okay, fine. Well, now you're clean and sober, at least the last 10 days. So now's your opportunity to tell James how much you love him, how much you miss him, and just reveal yourself. And what happens, you never know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I will tell you, I've never seen anyone not step through the mirror. Mm-hmm. What happens is people step through the mirror, and they just go right there. And suddenly, this guy who was sitting there talking quite rationally while my friend died, suddenly this guy is sobbing uncontrollably. And it's real. It's not an act. He's really experiencing what the grief is. You know, that's an example of psychodrama. So
the sobbing part that he obviously hadn't done before, does that cure the grief?
Well, there's no such thing as cure with anything. It's all a process. But what it does several things. Number one, it lightens the load.
Mm.
Number two, it puts you in touch with how you actually feel. And people don't understand, Joe, that you have a right to your feelings. You know, they're your feelings. You know, do something with them. Live them. Be them. You know, and you largely can let that go. It doesn't mean that you'll never grieve again or never grieve for that person again.
Right.
But you've lightened the load. You've gotten honest with yourself and with your own soul and with the memory of your friend and so on. Now, is that a cure? No. It's a little door opening about a way to live your life. It's an indicator that, you know, I could do this with other things.
Yeah.
I could just get honest with myself about how I feel.
These are tools that one carries with them for everything else.
Exactly.
What about these people that say that if something bad happens to them, it just goes through them and they never think about it? I mean, are they lying to us? Are they lying to themselves?
They're lying to themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course they feel it. Of course they feel it. And in fact, such persons, and you don't really meet a lot of them, the more they say that and the calmer they are saying that, the more you realize you're in the company of a sociopath or a psychopath. Mm-hmm. And it's time for a lunch break, you know, because there's not much you can do.
Yeah. So one of the quotes here on this card that you gave me, David Berner is one of the most brilliant and creative therapists in Canada. That's from Dr. Yablonsky. When you think about all these people that you've helped over the years, I mean, is that where the reward is? Are you proud of that, say?
Completely. It's the thing I'm most proud of. You know, I've loved my life in showbiz. It's been hysterical fun. I've had so much fun. I've been so lucky to meet so many interesting characters and great memories and great tales and so on. But the rewards of working with people, you know, who are struggling and suffering, and you see them sort of grab onto a bit of a life raft, and you see them, you know, starting to rebuild. I mean, I won't say when, but not so long ago, I was working with somebody. And I said, I thought of you the other day, and I thought of a sentence. And I'd like you to close your eyes and make yourself comfortable. And now try this sentence on for size.
Mm-hmm.
And the person said, okay. And I said, here's the sentence. I have stopped running. Whoa.
Mm.
And that turned into a huge therapeutic conversation.
Yeah.
Because here's a person who has spent his or her whole life running around in circles chasing sex, drugs, rock and roll, you know, whatever people chase, you know. And now this person has got a partner and a child and work and is building a sane life and doesn't need to be excited 92 hours a day, understands that, that life isn't doesn't really work that way, you know. And so another sniff of coke is not going to help, you know. What helps is having a partner, a child, a work, you know, building something. Yeah, so it's unbelievably rewarding.
What does that say about where we are in society, where there is a need to talk, but few people are actually willing to do the work, say, or help even?
Well, Joe, you've hit the nail on the head about a major social problem. We've never lived in an era with so much talk. All you have to do is walk down the street, and you will have 42 teenage girls talking into their cell phones. I shouldn't be prejudiced just to teenage girls. Everybody, but they seem to dominate. Any cafe, if there's five people at a table in a coffee shop, there's seven cell phones. You know, and we're all talking. Everybody's talking nonstop. The problem is, what in God's name are they talking about? And of what use is it? You know, it's not, of course, a lot of talk is just fun, frivolous drivel. But so the other problem is that the powers that be, especially when it comes to drug addiction and alcoholism, they believe that the answers are all in pharmacology. And they believe that there will be a pill for something and a pill for that. And now, you know, I make this joke that, you know, here, what are some of your favorite oxymorons? Happy marriage, Catholic university, liquor control board, military intelligence. But now we have cornered the market on the ultimate oxymoron here in this province and in Canada. But the people who run this crap are having an effect all over the world. Opioid replacement therapy. Well, I understand the phrase opioid replacement. You give someone who's wired for you know, heroin or whatever, fentanyl, you give them another drug, you know. I get that. I don't think it's useful. I think it's insane. I think all you're doing is keeping people stupid and stoned. But opioid replacement therapy? You can't do therapy when someone's high. They're mutually exclusive concepts. You know, I have people, every person I've ever worked with knows you don't talk to David when you're high or drunk because he's not going to talk to you. Because I don't. There's nothing, I'm not going to talk to a bottle of gin and I'm not going to talk to a cap of heroin. For me, that's not a conversation.
How do you get to where you are, though, as a therapist? I mean, one would assume that you would have to do some of the same work so that you can help people. And so I'm wondering if there are problems in your life that you're dealing with. Are they made easier because you've done this therapy work with others?
I don't know if they're made easier. I certainly they allow me to have some insights into what's crawled up my ass and died today. You know, I'm not bad at insight into what, you know, what some of my issues are. In many ways, I'm as hopeless as most people. You know, I can help you, but I can't help me very much. A lot of addicts and ex-convicts that I've worked with have assumed that I'm an addict or an ex-convict. And I'm not, but like addicts and ex-convicts, in many ways, I have felt to be an outsider. I felt that I don't belong. I felt under about seven different categories that I'm from Mars, you know. I'm just an odd character. And so I understand their feeling of not qualifying, of not being good enough, of being an odd man out or something. You know, I get that. I just don't want to be drunk about it. I don't want to be stoned about it. you know. I mean, I was drunk and stoned when I was in my late teens and first few years of my 20s, and then I just stopped.
Yeah. But it, what was that a response to something that had happened in your life, or was that what everyone your age was doing at the time?
Both.
Yeah.
Both. Yeah, yeah, it was the world. You know, I mean, I predated the hippies, but I was here in Vancouver, you know, in my early 20s, and everything was about drinking and smoking pot and, mm-hmm. and going to dances and dancing all weekend and so on. And it was a lot of fun
yeah.
when I was 20, except that I have no interest in that today. And even after the time I was 24, I had very little interest. Yeah.
What was it about Vancouver? Because you're kind of guy through your work who could have moved anywhere, lived anywhere, worked anywhere. What's kept you here?
Well, I had first of all, I had traveled to Europe when I was 19. I had spent a year in Europe, and it was an eye opener. Sort of my mind was blown apart by seeing parts of the world and the way people live.
That especially at that age, right?
Yeah, and I saw stunning poverty in small towns in Spain and so on, and that I didn't know existed. And I came back to Winnipeg, and then I stayed for about a year and a half, and I just couldn't get out fast enough. And I came here on a Christmas holiday on a Greyhound bus. Well, first of all, I couldn't believe that there was a place in Canada with evergreen trees and green grass in December, you know?
Yeah.
And secondly, we were by the ocean, and having grown up at the confluence of two rivers, once I saw the ocean, I was hooked. The first ocean I saw was the Atlantic.
Yeah.
And once I saw oceans, it's like, oh, I have to always be near that.
Yeah.
I don't even want to be near a lake. I want to be near an ocean because I want that tide. I want to see those waves. And, yeah. You know, so and I want to smell the salt water. And so and Vancouver, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, was a very inexpensive place to live and had the best climate in the country. And so it was an easy place. And it was a natural that it should be the sort of northern extension of Haight-Ashbury and of Esalen and the, you know, the human potential movement. All that stuff drifted up with the spores from Southern California. Yeah. And so this has been my home for the better part of 50 years, and I've loved it.
Yeah. And so when you think about it, I mean, because of your time on the radio, you become such a part of this town, especially the conversation, especially in this town, because, you know, both shows that you were, both stations that you worked at,
yes.
were leading
yes.
in the market, you know, in terms of conversation. Even if CGR wasn't the number one station in this town, people listened to it. And so to be part of the city that way, I mean, that must have been, I don't know, I'll ask you, what did that feel like?
It was wonderful. It was tremendously exciting. I mean, first of all, there are certain perks that go with being in the media and especially with being in talk radio. And the first is that you get free tickets to everything. So here's a couple of classic examples. You remember the Grizzlies?
Yeah.
The Grizzlies, our basketball team that lasted a few seasons. Okay, so I worked at NW when the Grizzlies were here. So I could walk in to the stadium anytime and see any Grizzlies game. I didn't need a ticket. I just showed up. Okay. Oh. Now, I didn't have to stay in the media box. So I was down in the parquet many, many nights. And two nights, I remember. One was, I'm behind a bunch of tables where guys are talking into microphones, and I suddenly, my head exploded. I went, oh, my God, that's Bob Cousy and Tommy Heinsohn. You know, these guys, they are the Boston Celtics, you know, from my era.
Yeah.
I remember as a kid watching Bob Cousy, who, you know, was short compared to today's players. He was like 6 feet tall. I'm 6 feet tall, you know.
Yeah.
And this guy could dribble like Steph, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, he was like a freak of dribbling, you know. And Heinsohn was, anyway. So that was one experience. Then this was even funnier. One night I'm down on the parquet floor, and I'm standing right at the entrance to the tunnel where the players go to the locker rooms. And I'm just standing there doing nothing, just soaking it in. Like, it's terribly exciting to stand there and see the crowds yelling and everything. And some guy comes out, wanders out, and stands next to me. And I didn't even look at him. I just noticed that there was a person near me who was very tall, but I didn't, and wasn't in basketball clothes.
Right.
It was in street clothes. Anyway, then all of a sudden, I realized there's like 20,000 people looking at me. And I go, well, why would they look at me? Nobody, you know, there's like seven people here who know me. And then I look up, and the guy who happens to be standing next to me in this colorful sweater is Larry Bird. Right?
Yeah.
And I'm going, I'm standing next to Larry Bird. This is beyond exciting, you know? So, yeah, I mean, you felt you were part of everything. And you, of course, I saw every opera, every ballet, every rock and roll show. You know, and I met these people. I had these wonderful, here, I'll give you one. I may have told you this, but this is one of my favorite stories. You know, when Ted Neely and Carl Anderson came here, which they did several times, playing in Jesus Christ Superstar, and they were the two guys playing those roles in the in the Norman Jewison film, right? So they appeared when I was at NW doing Midnight to 4 in the Morning. So they appeared as my guests, and then this terribly funny thing happened. You have to remember that Ted Neely looked like Jesus, at least what we think Jesus looked like.
I mean, he
was perfect.
What we see on the posters.
Yeah, what we see on the posters. Yeah. I mean, it was amazing. So we had this great interview, and they were delightful guys, and I sort of became buddies with them and hung around backstage and everything. But anyway, so now it's 1 o'clock and the news is on, and I'm walking them to the door. They're leaving, and they're with the publicist, who's a friend of mine.
Yeah.
But typical publicist, I say to her, oh, by the way, as we're walking towards the door, I said, by the way, I need a couple more tickets. Well, yeah, and she starts whining, kvetching, problems, right?
Yeah.
And Ted, I wish there were TVs, people could see this. Ted Neely turns, looks at me, raises his palm, you know, to buy his cheek, you know, and says, I know people. I mean, Jesus said to me, I know people. You know, I got tickets, of course.
That's the career, right?
Well,
right there, Jesus gave you tickets.
Yeah, I mean, of course it's fun. It's ridiculous fun. And I would say even today, I haven't been on the radio since 2006, although I did my Shaw show for years. Even today, at the age of 76, I walk down the street, and at least once a week, someone stops me and starts chatting. And, oh, I loved you on the radio. I loved you on TV, blah, blah, blah. What are you doing? You know, which is kind of silly fun.
You were at NW in the 90s, through the 90s and through the early part of the – and then you left, and then you came back for a bit. You did weekends.
Yeah.
But in those years when you were on Midnight – to 4, and across the country.
Yes,
some people will say that that's the sort of the end of the era of talk radio in this town. I mean, you go back to Burns in the 60s up to that point, especially CKNW, that station with all the other people that were there with you. That was maybe the last time that talk radio was influential.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun doing that midnight show, but I was happiest when I was doing 7 to 10
in
just
the evenings?
In the province at NW. And I agree with you. I'm going to comment on that in a minute. But you mentioned what's Burns' first name?
Pat Burns.
Pat Burns. You mentioned Pat Burns, and you know Pat Burns was a phenomenon in this town. I don't know if you recall, but at one point he rented the Queen Elizabeth Theater. Because he had some big
political... He'd been fired, and so this was his chance to talk to his audience.
Yeah, and they had to put speakers out on the plaza because there were thousands of people. And I remember I was at...
In the Chuck Davis book, I think it's intimated that NW had rented the Queen Elizabeth Theater after CGR fired him.
So I remember I was a yellow taxi driver at the time. And we were going up Georgia Street heading east, and my passenger said, what's all that? I said, oh, it's some nutty talk show host. Anyway, then I end up at CJOR, and Pat Burns was my lead-in. He did like 6:30 to 10,
in the
and
evening.
I did 10 to 1 in the morning. and when I did A Little Burner in the Night, and he changed the ending of his show for me. He was, Pat Burns and I just, I'll come back to your question.
Sure.
Pat Burns and I were at opposite ends of the world in many ways. I mean, he was a pretty serious drinker, and I was a pretty serious abstainer.
Yeah.
And he was very right of center, and I was very left of center. But two things. First of all, the guy was an historian. He could tell you how many bullets were fired in which particular skirmish in World War II, in which location. You know, the guy was a wizard. He was an encyclopedia of stuff like that. And secondly, for my money, he was one of the most startlingly brilliant broadcasters I've ever heard. And this is what he did. He massaged a microphone.
Yeah.
And this is what he did to end his show once I said. He was so kind to me. I loved the guy.
Yeah.
he changed the ending, and he'd go like this. Okay, that's it for us, dolls. But don't change the dial. Because a guy's coming on now, and let me tell you, he's funny. And he would give me this big bit of love. They'd do, we'd have the news, and then I'd come on. Now, yes, it was, you know, I think talk radio basically ended when Rafe got fired. Rafe is the guy who got me into talk radio, by the way, at OR.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Rafe was the god of CKNW, and we had a lot of these gods lined up, because Frosty did the morning show, and nobody could touch him.
Yeah.
He owned the mornings. Rafe owned that whatever, 9 to noon slot, or 8:30 to whenever it was. Bill Goo owned his part of, you know, and so on. I had killer ratings from 7 to 10.
Yeah.
I had a 14 share. Nobody today in local radio has a 14 share, you know.
Yeah.
So, it was a heady time, and we were the giant 98. We were, I mean, that station was unstoppable. Now, the erosion of it is about many, many things. All of it has to do with money, you know, and not, we'd like to blame certain personalities or even certain corporate entities. But the truth is, that's where the world was going. I mean, the digitization of the world has resulted in 100 other platforms, you know, that people want to do Instagram, and they want podcasts, and they do all this other stuff. And certainly broadcasting went the way of the dodo bird. Now, in fact, when we speak of broadcasting, we should more accurately call it narrowcasting, because you really can only get an audience by zoning in on sports. And sometimes in sports, you have to get an audience by just doing football or just doing a tennis show or something, you know. So the day of a station, if you think about when Rick Honey was there, Rick would have guests, he'd play music, he'd do the weather and traffic and spray, he'd do a bit of everything. And he got by on his personality and his charm and his ubiquitousness and his knowing everything and everybody in the city, you know. Nobody does that anymore.
Yeah.
And in large measure, it's a dreadful shame because it was great radio. I mean, I still am very much in touch with Bill Hughes. And Bill Hughes is the guy who built NW into the juggernaut that it was for so many years. What was Chuck's book was called Top Dog.
Right.
All right. And I just snuck into it because I had just joined. And so he put me in somewhere near the end.
Yeah.
It was the top dog, and you couldn't, you know, nobody could get near it. But Bill Hughes, who built that station, was one of the craftiest radio people in Canadian history. You know, he has said for years, it's over. That era is over and done.
Yeah.
And he was another guy who was a guy older than me, who was very kind to me, became a great friend. I met him at a concert where I was standing outside about to go into the concert, and the producer of the concert came outside and said, David, would you be the MC? And I said, sure. So I was the MC. And Bill and his wife were there, and he approached me, and he said, David, you're one of the last people at NW who will appear in public. Most people, they're good behind the microphone,
yeah,
but they can't, they don't have it to be out in public.
Yeah. The, in that Carol Channing interview,
yes,
she mentions that she was in an agent's office, and the two people sitting next to her on either side were Adolph Green and Betty Comden and Alfred Drake. And I was thinking to myself, I was listening to this tape, it's 1994 when you did that interview with Carol Channing. There's no one left in this town who'll know who those people were.
Well, you're right, and B, I would, anybody who listens to this piece, I encourage you to find, it shows up on TV regularly, on TCM regularly, and I've saved my copy on my TV set. To me, it's even better than Singing in the Rain. I mean, Singing in the Rain is a great movie,
yeah,
but my all-time favorite musical is The Bandwagon with Fred Astaire and Sid Charisse. And Nanette Febre and Oscar Levant play the writers of comedy musicals, musical comedies. And that movie was written by
Comden and Green.
Comden and Green.
Yeah.
And they are playing, Nanette Fabre and Oscar Levant are playing Comden and Green,
yeah,
very wittily and very funny, and they sing and dance as well. And, you know, I really am from another era. Hey, look, just to show you how the truth of this, my second heart attack, which was like 8 years ago, the you dial 911, and I this is a piece of advice for people. If you're ever lonely, dial 911 and tell them you're having a heart attack, because I had eight hunky guys in my kitchen in 5 minutes, and they're all pawing over you trying to help you. You know, it's a wonderful thing. Anyway, so they put me on a gurney, and they schlepped me out of my house, and they put me in this ambulance, and we're going to VGH. Now, we don't have the whirly bird or the siren, but it is 1:30 in the morning, and, you know, and we're screaming through Vancouver streets. And this guy, I'm on this gurney, and I'm sort of propped up, but I am wired. I've got IV drips. I've got heart monitors. I got electricity all over me, and I'm sort of sitting up. And this guy who's sitting with me, he's maybe 30, and he makes the mistake of saying to me, "So, Mr. Berner, are you comfortable?" And I said, "That's an old vaudeville bit." And he's 30, so he doesn't know what vaudeville means.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Any of your listeners who don't know, this was sort of the turn-of-the-century America.
Like the Ed Sullivan Show, but they would tour the whole show.
It started with Yiddish theater in New York, and then So anyway, so he doesn't know what vaudeville means. I says, well, it was you know, part of New York theater stuff, turn of the century. I said, it's a joke. You want to hear it? And he says, sure. This is called David Goes for a Heart Attack.
Yeah, right?
This is how I go for a heart attack. So he says, you want to hear it? Yeah. I says, okay, here's the joke. An old man is crossing Times Square. He gets knocked down by a streetcar. You see the vintage of the joke. Yeah? He gets knocked down by a streetcar. A crowd gathers around, oohing and aahing. A cop comes along. He pushes his way to the center of the crowd. He takes off his pea jacket. He rolls it up. He gingerly, carefully lifts the old man's head. He slips the jacket under the guy's head. He says, sir, are you comfortable? And the old guy looks up and goes, I got a few dollars put away. So, I mean, I basically have, you know, that's me. I do, you know what I've loved about radio? I did terribly serious, hard-hitting issues, you know, night after night, day after day. We fought with people on the air, all that stuff. And I also did one stupid gag after another. Here's one of my all-time favorites, which I'll do for you.
Yeah.
One day, we came out of the 8 o'clock news. This is when I was doing 7 to 10. We came out of the 8 o'clock news, and the music plays, and what's-his-face is that, well, who's the guy who did all the voices all those years? You know him.
Jim Conrad?
Conrad, yeah. Conrad's voice. Now back to the David Berner. Anyway, I can't do his voice. It's such a great voice.
Yeah.
And the music plays, and it comes to me, and I go, folks, this just off the news wire, the kids in the newsroom, they had a packed newscast, so they couldn't get this in, so I'm gonna share it with you. Amazing little story. Out of Carmen, Manitoba, apparently earlier this evening, the entire city council of Carmen, Manitoba, voted unanimously to change the name of the town to Carmen. So, you know,
I
can't help myself. And I used to make a joke at this station all the time, and I'd say it on the air. I'd say, yeah, I only pay them $50 a night to do this. I'd say, I'm amazed that people pay me to misbehave. People pay me to be an idiot, you know.
It's been such fun to talk again, and for you to come in to do this and urge.
Before you go up and close, it's such fun because you're such a great interviewer. You know, you should be world famous. No, you're a marvelous interviewer. You do your homework, you ask the right questions, and best yet, you ask a question and you just sit and listen to the answer.
Well, you're very kind. Thank you so much. DavidBurner.com is the website. And then, of course, an evening with David Burner is at the PAL Studio Theater, 581 Cardero in Vancouver, Saturday, the 30th of March, 8 p.m. Tickets are at the door. You're asked to give at least $20 a person. And, of course, the Psychodrama Experience is Saturday, the 20th of April, Sunday, the 21st as well. The Granville Island Hotel, visit newhistory.ca/psychodrama to make reservations. And for more information, David Burner, join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.